Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 160. I'm recording it on Friday, August 28th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 18. That's not awful, but it's not real good. I would say that stocks offer a better value proposition than they did from 1996 through 2008, but I would be cautious about my stock allocation. My personal belief is that the typical middle-class investor should not be going with an allocation of much more than 40% at these prices and in this environment. The title of the musical selection is Cool Strut. This is not most of the podcast. The music is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech. This is not the case with this one. I had purchased a bunch of royalty-free music that I don't have to pay royalties on, and this is one of those selections, Cool Strut. Most of those are jazz, sort of a jazz combo. And the title of the podcast is True Diversification. There was a blog I was at this morning, and they were talking about diversification, and I thought I ought to record a podcast on diversification. I have a section of the book that I'm working on that will be on, it'll be a title, True Diversification. And might even be a chapter, probably a section, but possibly a chapter. It's an important enough topic to justify a chapter of the book. It's very important. But the reason I'm reluctant to make it a chapter is that my thinking on diversification is not sufficiently advanced to make it a chapter. So everything I say in this podcast is somewhat tentative. I think I've given some thought to the topic, and I want to put forward those thoughts, but we really need, I've said many times, we need a national debate on the flaws in the passive investing model and on the development of the rational investing model. And if we had a national debate, I would have hundreds of smart people contributing their thoughts, and it would help me to sharpen my thinking on diversification. It would obviously help them as well and would help all the people listening in. But we don't have that today. What we have today is a stock selling industry that is rigid and it doesn't want to hear that it has made mistakes. And the result is we're not moving forward as quickly as we should be in the development of better investing advice. And that means that our understanding, I say in general, our understanding of stock investing is primitive. Our understanding of how to achieve effective diversification is not what it should be. And, you know, the purpose of the podcast is for me to move the ball forward to the extent I can by putting forward some new ideas, but there's only so much I can do. I only have one brain and one set of life experiences and one personality. And in order to really dig deep and develop this topic to the extent it needs to be developed, we need to have hundreds of people with different personalities, different ways of thinking, and different sets of life experiences all contributing. So I apologize that the thinking here will not be as sharp as I would like it to be. My hope is that we can get some discussion going on this topic and on many others, and you know that would help me, because if all the things you see at PassionSaving.com today, all the investing ideas were developed in communities. They were not developed by some guy sitting in a room thinking grand thoughts. They were developed in communities on the internet. And I learned by, you know, having people come back and say, no, Rob, you're wrong about this, or Rob, here's a better way to think about it, or, oh, did you, you know, exploring an implication of something I said? Here's some data, Rob, that supports you. Here's some data that indicates maybe you're not on the right track. And all that stuff helps. And we need more of that. So it's a tentative podcast, but, you know, not an unimportant one, because the topic of diversification is so important. Now, let me start by saying how diversification is supposed to work. I'll give you the theory. Well, the very first prefatory remark I want to make is, well, let me describe the theory. I better do that. The idea of diversification, there's a magic to it. Magic to it. The idea of diversification is, this is all conventional. This isn't what I think is true. I'm going to describe the conventional way of looking at things. The conventional way of looking at things is that the reason why stocks provide a high average long-term return is that stocks are risky. Part of the conventional advice, the passive investing model is risk equals long-term reward. I don't think that's true. I won't go into it, but there are other podcasts that discuss risk, several of them. And I believe it is generally perceived risk that generates long-term return, not risk, not actual risk. It's perceived risk that matters. But let's just say that risk equals long-term return, and the quote-unquote experts will often translate that into volatility. I also don't agree with that. Volatility is not necessarily the same thing as risk, but they will translate it that way. So they will say an asset class that is more volatile is an asset class that is more risky, which is an asset class that gives a higher long-term return. All the logic follows. There is a logic to the conventional advice. It's just rooted in premises that don't stand up to scrutiny. So, if all that were true, then stocks are the best asset class because they've got the most volatility, which means they have the most risk, which means they have the greatest long-term return. So stocks are it. However, even the passive investing advocates will acknowledge that stocks have a problem, that this extreme volatility is emotionally unsettling, to say the least. So stocks can be great for many years and provide long-term returns, but then you'll get into a time period where stocks are a wipeout. You lose 50% of your money or 80% of your money, whatever it happens to be. In the late 1920s, early 1930s, there was an 80% drop in real terms. And people can't hold on, so they sell. And instead of getting, 6.5 average long-term return, they end up with a long-term return of 2% or a negative return because they sell at the bottom. Because this volatility, which they praise, they say that's the key to getting a good long-term return, will also kill you if you're not prepared for just how bad it can get. And very few investors are even a tiny bit prepared because the stock selling industry doesn't like to talk about how bad volatility can get. That's one of the things that is hushed up and taboo. So, all right, that's the general story on stocks, according to the conventional, not Rob Bennett, according to the conventional thinking. That's the passive model, not the rational model. Now, they say, okay, we've got this asset class. We found the perfect asset class, highly, highly volatile, which means it must be risky, which means it must have a great long-term return. All of this follows, logically. Now, we can't own all this asset class because the downward swings are just too great. We can't take it. So what do we do? Well, the theory is, what if you could find another asset class? Let's call it asset class X, that is almost as volatile as stocks, which means it's almost as risky as stocks, which means it has a long-term return almost equal to stocks. But with one big difference, and the difference is when stocks go down, this asset class goes up in value. And when stocks go up in value, this asset class goes down in value. So it doesn't replicate stocks, but it performs as close to how stocks perform as possible. With one big exception, the downward movements in stocks are countered with upward movements, and the upward movements in stocks are countered with downward movements. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And it would, because what you would be doing if you could counter stocks in that way, and if all the rest were true, which it's not, but if all the rest were true and you could counter stocks in that way, you would have the best of all worlds. You would have two asset classes that both are high volatility, which means both are high risk, which means both have high returns, but you personally would not be experiencing the downside of the volatility. Because whenever the one asset class had a big drop, say a 50% drop, you'd say, oh, holy moly, my stocks have gone down 50%. This is terrible. Well, then you would look at you'd have 50% in stocks and 50% in asset class X. And as soon as you started feeling bad about stocks, you'd look at the other side of your portfolio and you'd say, wait a minute here. I got a 50% gain in asset class X. I'm fine. No problem. So you would have all the benefits of volatility and none of the detriments. That's the theory of what you're trying to achieve with diversification under the conventional model. Now, as I say, there are so many fallacies in that setup that I don't even know if I can count them all. They're just, it's all so mixed up and confused. It wouldn't serve any purpose to go through. I've talked about a lot of these things in other podcasts, so I don't want to repeat it. And it's just all so confused, you can't make any sense out of it. Not that there's not any truth in this. There are important truths being pointed to. I'm not saying this is all nonsense. It's half-truths. And this is characteristic of the passive investing model. The passive investing model is a model of half-truths. And this is what makes it so frustrating, because whenever you find something wrong with it and you point out what's wrong, the people trying to defend it will say, oh, no. Here's evidence that it's true. And it'll show that, yes, it is a half-truth. But they ignore the evidence that it's not true, and they keep pushing this model, which has been discredited, at least as it is promoted. It has truth in it, but the truth is dangerous because the things that are overlooked can kill you. Half-truths are sometimes more dangerous than out-and-out lies, because half-truths will win your confidence in a way that out-and-out lies never will. So I don't buy this idea. I don't buy almost any of those premises. I don't buy the idea that, volatility equals risk. What risk is about is uncertainty. Risk is the possibility of experiencing a loss. Volatility, if stocks go up, that's volatility. That's a change. Volatility is just a change in price. If stocks go up, that's volatility. Does that make stocks risky? That they can double in price? Does that make them risky? That makes them wonderful. So volatility is not equal to risk. And risk is not equal to return. Stocks were the riskiest they've ever been in history in January of 2000. And the return they've provided has been awful. The fact that they were more risky than they've ever been before did not translate into good returns. And it never does, or it rarely does. You just can't, or at least let's say it often does not. You cannot say that risk equals return. It's just false. It's half true, half false. And if you start believing it, you're going to get in trouble. So our understanding today of diversification is greatly flawed. Yet diversification is incredibly important. So we need to be studying it. And I'm going to offer some tentative thoughts on how I think diversification works and what I think you should be doing to make your portfolio diversified. Now, the other point I wanted to make as a prefatory point earlier, and first I wanted to describe the conventional model, is diversification is a free lunch. You'll often hear passive investors say there's no such thing as a free lunch. It's one of their half-truths they love to turn to. It's good to be skeptical about something that appears to be a free lunch, because it's true that there are a lot of people trying to sell you stuff in this world, and they will present a case that's too good to be true, and the phrase, there is no such thing as a free lunch, is a skeptical phrase, and it's healthy to be skeptical of these claims. So there's a half-truth in the statement, there's no such thing as a free lunch. But if you really start believing that there's no such thing as a free lunch, you're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble, because there is such a thing as a free lunch. There are a lot of free lunches in this life. And if you pass them all by, you're going to miss out on a lot of great stuff. And diversification is a free lunch if there ever was one. Look at that example I gave you under the conventional model. If we could find an asset class X that always performed the opposite of stocks and that provided an equal return, we could match the return of stocks without suffering anything on the downside. That would be a free lunch. We can't replicate it that way, and they don't claim that we can. But they do claim through diversification you can do something close to that, that you can find different asset classes that perform in opposite ways, that counter each other. And therefore, you can get higher returns at lower risk. And if higher returns at a lower risk isn't a free lunch, I don't know what is. So diversification itself, which is central to the passive investing model, is a wonderful example of how there is such a thing as a free lunch. And I'd be grateful if the passive investing advocates would stop saying there's no such thing as a free lunch. What they do with that statement, with the dogmatic insistence that there's no such thing as a free lunch, is they stop learning in its tracks. Every time somebody comes up with a good idea that is not, does not fit in the passive investing model, their answer is there's no such thing as a free lunch, and they mock it and they ridicule it. They say it can't work. You know, timing can't work, because if timing worked, it would be a free lunch. Everybody would want a time. Can't happen, but it can happen. We've demonstrated with the historical data that long-term timing always works. Long-term timing gives you higher returns at lower risk. And diversification is another example of the same phenomenon. And since the passive investing advocates won't admit, at least a lot of them won't admit, that long-term timing works, some will today. But many are skeptical. John Bogle himself has admitted this. He admitted it with his feet dragging. I think it was the last podcast I did, or maybe two back, I talked about John Bogle. John Bogle says that valuation-informed indexing can work. He dragged his feet. He said he wouldn't do it, but he acknowledged that it can work. He acknowledged that there are circumstances in which long-term timing works. It gives higher returns at lower risk. So that's a free lunch. And the same thing's here. So anybody who tells you there's no such thing as a free lunch, just bring up diversification and say, is that a free lunch? Because all passive investors that I know of advocate diversification, and diversification is a free lunch. So the idea there's no such thing as a free lunch is baloney. All right. I gave you the theory on how diversification is supposed to work. The idea is to counter, to put in your portfolio different asset classes that perform in opposite ways. It's critical that they perform in opposite ways, because if they don't, the diversification magic does not kick in. The whole idea is, so for example, say you own stocks and you owned, asset class X, that is the opposite of stocks. Some people would have those two. Say you had 50% of each, because you want to be perfectly diversified. You want perfect diversification, which is a good idea. Yeah, there is no such asset class, but if there were. Some people would say, when stocks were going up, they'd be saying, I wish I didn't own 50% asset class X. It's holding me back. It's lowering my return. The intelligent investor, and the passive investors are right on this point. They're right on a lot of things. They're right on this point. The intelligent investor would say, no. You don't want to have 100% stocks. You want to have 50% asset class X. Sure, this year stocks are going up more. But you can't know in advance which year stocks are going to go up and which they're going to go down. And by owning 50% of each, you're covered in every possibility. When stocks go up, asset class X goes down. And when stocks go down, asset class X goes up. So in the long term, you're going to end up ahead. If you were not to be diversified, if you were to go solely with stocks because you think stocks are going to go up this year, you would end up behind the diversified investor because you can't guess those times effectively. And that would mean that there'd be years when you were heavy in stocks and stocks went down and you'd have no counter. And the end result would be you'd end up worse off than the diversified investor. That's very strong logic, very strong magic. And that's what I am trying to achieve with valuation-informed indexing, effective diversification. Let me explain. And I talked about this in one earlier podcast, so I'll be brief. But the usual diversification that passive investors argue for is diversification of stocks and bonds. The usual argument is you should own, they usually don't say 50-50. I don't know if there is a standard, but I'd say the standard is usually something like 60% stocks, 40% bonds, or 70% stocks, 30% bonds, something like that. That's the standard advice. And, they'll say change it as you get closer to retirement. Go more heavy in bonds after you retire, something like that. But if you're looking for a standard, it would be 60-70% stocks, 30, 40% bonds, or maybe, you know, they usually have about 5% cash thrown in there, so maybe it would only be, you know, 35% bonds, something like that. 60 or 70% stock. That's the usual advice. So they're not saying that stocks and bonds, the reason why they go heavier with stocks is stocks have a higher average long-term return. They call it the equity risk premium. So, and since they call it the risk premium, what they're suggesting is that stocks are more volatile than bonds. They believe that volatility equals return, and that while bonds are volatile, certainly they're more volatile than cash, they are not as volatile as stocks, and therefore the return isn't quite so high. So they generally advocate going with more stocks than bonds, but countering your stocks with bonds. So maybe a 70-25-5 mix. 70% stocks, 25% bonds, 5% cash, something like that. There's different mixes. Different people have different mixes. But they like stocks because more than bonds because the two don't have the same return. So bonds are not asset class X. They're not as volatile as stocks. They don't have as much return as stocks. So they're not asset class X. If there were an asset class X, the passive investors would advocate owning that instead of bonds. But there is none. So bonds are sort of the closest they can come to. Now, I question the whole model. I think the problem is this model has been discredited. The stock selling industry is rigid. It doesn't want to hear about the problems. It doesn't want to change the conventional advice. It thinks it's got a good deal going. They've been making lots of money promoting passive investing, and they don't want to change. They don't want to know about the problem, so they bury their heads in the ground. They don't acknowledge. And I think we need to acknowledge them and start fixing it, coming up with a better model, a non-passive model. So one of the things I question is, are bonds really worth owning? Now, again, I don't want to go into this in any great depth. I did it in an earlier podcast. I think it was called What Should You Own When You Don't Own Stocks? The idea that bonds are the natural counter to stocks is an old idea. It's been around for a long time. It does make some sense. It's not a foolish idea. But I think it's an outdated idea. And the reason it's outdated, well, there's more than one reason. One reason is this whole question of volatility. I don't think volatility equals risk. So the whole framework and the idea that risk equals return doesn't work. So the premises are fallacious. And so the conclusions people drew from the premises are at least they're not necessarily wrong. It could be they're wrong. They're right for different reasons than what we thought, but they shouldn't be cast in stone. The idea that everyone should be going with something like 70% stocks, 35% or 70% stocks, 25% bonds, 5% cash doesn't. There's too many things we don't know to say that that's so. But bonds for several reasons, are a questionable counter to stocks. One, I don't want to go into this for a long time, but one reason I don't like it is most middle-class investors don't understand bonds. And if you don't understand an asset class, you shouldn't own it, in Rob Bennett's opinion. So that rules bonds out right away. If you're going to own bonds, you're going to have to spend some time learning about bonds. And that can be done. You can go to the library. You know, Bill Gross, I think, is sort of known as the expert on bonds. Get a book by Bill Gross and read it. Find out how bonds work. And then, sure, bonds can be a good investment class. But if you don't understand bonds, I don't think they're a good idea. They could possibly be more dangerous than stocks. Because if you understand stocks, and you know most people don't understand stocks either, unfortunately, but that's not because they're not addressed. They're written about all the time. People don't understand them because most people are hearing it through the passive investing model. But if you understood stocks and you didn't understand bonds, I would argue in those circumstances, bonds are more risky than stocks because you're going to bail on bonds if you don't understand them. You're going to bail at the wrong time. Whereas if you understand stocks, you can stick with them. So if you don't understand bonds, you shouldn't be in them. They're not a good counter. But a second reason they're not a good counter is inflation has become a reality in the modern day. This inflation wasn't a big factor in the years when people came up with the idea that bonds are the way to go as a counter to stocks. So bonds were a great investment class. They were not as volatile as stocks, and yet they gave pretty darn healthy returns. So they were a good choice. But investors got killed in bonds when we had the hyperinflation of the 70s. And that could happen starting tomorrow again. So bonds are arguably as risky as stocks. And if they're as risky and they don't give us good return, what good are they? I don't want to overstate that. I don't really believe that. I think bonds can be a good choice. Bonds were a better investment class than stocks during the time from 96 to 2008 when stocks were insanely overvalued. So I don't want to say that I don't think bonds are any good. But they're just, you can't just say by default they're the counter to stocks. I don't think that follows. And another big change is that we now have available to us an asset class called TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, and I-bonds that provide, I think, a better counter to stocks than bonds do. The diversification there, and basically valuation-informed indexing, is an investing strategy that is, the purpose was to keep it very, very simple so that the middle-class investor can use it. Can make use of it. And there's really only two asset classes you need to know about. One of them is TIPS and I-bonds, which are the simplest asset class on planet Earth. You know, they tell you right on the certificate what the return's going to be. So there's no guesswork whatsoever. They're covered for inflation, so they don't suffer from this detriment that bonds suffer from. It couldn't be more simple. You buy TIPS paying 3.5 real, and you're going to get 3.5 real. End of story. And then you got one other asset class, stocks, which stocks are a complicated asset class, but if you buy an index, they're not that complicated because you don't need to research the stocks. So buy a broad index, and stocks become simple. And then the only thing you need to know to make the whole thing go is how valuations affect long-term returns, and that's what 160 podcasts are about. So you got two simple asset classes, and you don't need to listen to 160 podcasts. If you listen to three or four, you could get the general idea, I think, and you're on your way. But valuation-informed indexing certainly makes use of diversification, and the diversification it makes use of is stocks versus TIPS. And I think TIPS are essentially asset class X. That's really what they are. They're the missing asset class that the passive investors have been looking for all these years and haven't been able to find. And it's been sitting under their nose. And they disdain it because they don't think the returns are high enough. But that's because they don't really grasp how returns are earned. I think TIPS are the perfect counter to stocks. Not because they're equally volatile. It's because they're not volatile at all. What the passive investors have been looking for is an asset class that is equally volatile as stocks, but that goes down when stocks go up and up when stocks go down. TIPS are not volatile at all. They have zero volatility. If they say they pay 3.5 real, they pay 3.5 real. That's it. No volatility. That's what you want to get diversification with stocks. You want zero volatility because the problem with stocks is the volatility. And it's gone when you have TIPS. It's erased. It's countered. Because TIPS stabilize the portfolio. So the whole job of asset allocation, in my view, is determining how much volatility you want, and then that's one step. That's internal. You know, you have to look at yourself, your life circumstances, your financial goals, and your risk tolerance, and say, okay, how much volatility can I stand? And then the second step is, how do I mix stocks and TIPS to attain that level of volatility? And the more TIPS you have, the less volatility you're going to have. The more TIPS you have, the less volatility you're going to have. You just, you know, you just play with it until you've got it right. And that's why you need a tool like the stock return predictor to tell you. But see, it's not really volatility you're trying to guard against. What you're trying to guard against is loss. So the stock return predictor will tell you how big your potential losses are with stocks. And when the potential losses are too high, you'll lower your allocation and get it down to where you need it to be. So tips are asset class X. The passive investors just don't see it because they're looking for the wrong thing. They're looking for an asset class with equal volatility to stocks, but that goes in the opposite direction. They've never found one. There is none. But with tips, we have the true alternative to stocks. The thing you should be trying to counter is not that the volatility move in an opposite direction, but that there not be volatility. That's how you achieve the magic of diversification. And tips will do it for you. You, of course, you have to consider valuations, you know, for this to work, because if you're at the same stock allocation at all times and you're trying to counter the volatility of stocks with tips, there is no way to do it. If from your risk tolerance, looking at your risk tolerance, you determine that at a time of low prices, you should be at a 90% stock allocation. Well, you sure don't want to be at a 90% stock allocation at a time of insanely high prices. But there is no one allocation that will work in all price environments. So what you might want to do is you might say, I want to be at 30% stocks, 70% tips at a time of high valuations, 60% stocks, 40% tips at a time of moderate valuations, and 30% stocks, 70% tips at a time of low valuations, 30, 60, 90. But there's all kinds of ways to do it. But the point is, the asset class X doesn't counter stocks by moving in the opposite direction. It counters stocks by being non-volatile. That's where I think the passive investors got on the wrong path. So true diversification can be achieved very, very, very easy today. You only need two asset classes, stocks and tips. You don't want to be owning individual stocks. You can do it with individual stocks if you're smart enough to choose. But for the average person, you can avoid all that muss and fuss and just go with a broad index. Go with a broad index fund, simple as can be. Go with a totally stable asset class, tips or I-bonds, simple as can be. And then you've got to spend a tiny bit of effort figuring out what is your risk tolerance, and secondly, what combination of stocks and tips is suitable for that risk tolerance at any given valuation level for stocks, and that's going to change. But that, I think that's the simplest, most effective way to tap into the magic of diversification, in Rob Bennett's opinion. Now, I want to talk about some other aspects of the question. There's a guy, Harry Brown, who came up with something called the permanent portfolio. And his idea, he questioned, as I have, the conventional investing wisdom. And he said, well, you don't get diversification by being just in stocks and bonds. And he's right. Passive investors won't acknowledge that, but he's right. The big problem is they say, look, get diversification by being in stocks and bonds. You know what? There are some environments where stocks and bonds counter each other. When stocks do well, bonds do poorly. And when stocks do poorly, bonds do well. That's true. Again, it's a half-truth. But there are other environments in which we've seen stocks and bonds both do well. And there are other environments in which we've seen stocks and bonds both do poorly. So what kind of diversification is that? It doesn't work. The diversification that is pushed by the passive investing advocates often does not work. Okay? If it doesn't work, when you find out it doesn't work, the thing you should do is go back to the drawing board, come up with a new plan, but they don't do that. They just keep pushing this stuff, and it just flat out does not work, and we have an historical record. It can be checked. Stocks and bonds do not always counter each other. And if they don't counter each other, You don't have the diversification you thought you had. And then, of course, what happens is people end up selling their stocks because the diversification is a protection against having to sell. That's what it is. But if the two asset classes you choose don't counter each other, you end up having to sell at those low points, which means you lose everything. You can lose decades of work. You don't want to get this stuff wrong. Now, you know, our knowledge is not perfect, and to some extent we can't help it that we get some things wrong. But whether stocks and bonds are a perfect counter, we have data to look at to determine this. And the data says, yes, sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. So the diversification just isn't there. But I can tell you it's there with tips, because I'm not saying tips perform the opposite of stocks. I'm saying tips are non-volatile. And that's a fact. The amount on the certificate is the amount you will get. Tips are an effective counter to stocks. Bonds are not. Bonds are a somewhat effective counter to stocks. To say that bonds are an effective counter to stocks is a half-truth. Sometimes true, sometimes false. Now, I'll take it a step further. One of the problems we're having is that bonds are not an effective counter to stocks. Well, guess what? It gets worse. For a lot of people trying to live through this crash, the pressure they are facing to sell stocks is they don't have an effective counter to stocks, so their entire portfolio is going down. But on top of that, they're also losing their jobs. The passive investors don't consider your job part of your portfolio, but it really is. Your portfolio, this is why I call the podcast True Diversification. True diversification has to include more than just your investment assets. It includes all assets that are producing wealth for you. And your job is a wealth-producing asset. We don't think of it that way, but it is. And if you lose your job, or you don't even have to lose it, if your job becomes unstable, that is going to increase your anxiety about your future, your financial future. And that happens at the same time stocks are going down, and at the same time bonds are going down, and at the same time your house value is going down. And when all, so that four hits. You got a hit on the stock side, a hit on the bond side, a hit on the house side, a hit on the job side. And on top of it, you've got a fifth hit, which is the media. The media now is negative. And that affects you psychologically. It affects all of us. Let's not kid ourselves. So five hits. When all five hits are coming at the same time, it's going to cause you to sell. And that's why passive investing never works in the real world. Because the passive investors ignore this. All they want to do is sell stocks. And so they go with half-truths. And they kid themselves into thinking that the flaws and the fallacies aren't that big a deal. But when the hit comes, it's five hammers pounding on your head. That's not diversification. If you've got stocks and bonds, and the stocks and bonds are going down, and your house is going down, and your job, you're either losing it, or you're at risk of losing it, and the media is filled with gloom and doom. No. Valuation-informed indexing doesn't work that way. You've got stocks and tips. When stocks are going down, tips are doing great. And it's more than that. It's not just that the tips are stable in price. It's not just that the tips aren't going down. It's that when stocks are going down, you are able to increase your stock allocation because the long-term payoff of stocks goes up when the price goes down. So when stocks are going down, you're feeling good. The long-term value of your portfolio is increasing. So there's no hit for you. And you may be, your house might be in jeopardy. You know, your house value might go down. And your job could be at risk. And, you know, you have to deal with this media stuff. So there are these other hammers. But it's a big counter to those hammers to first of all, have an asset class that is stable, the tips, and then also to understand how valuations affect long-term returns, which tells you that your portfolio, your long-term portfolio value is going up. I have a calculator at my website, the Investment Strategy Tester, and I I produced a guest blog entry for, I first offered it to a big blog, Get Rich Slowly. And I think it's the best guest blog entry I've ever written. He turned it down. J.D. Roth turned it down, and I offered it to Shaddox at Money and Such, and Shaddox ran it. And I think it's the most important guest blog I've ever written. And I'm reporting the results of the Investment Strategy Tester, which is a calculator that uses the historical stock return data as its engine, and it shows that the stock crash was a good thing for middle-class investors. That if you're 10 years away from retirement, your odds of meeting your retirement goals have improved. Have improved. Because of the stock crash. I report on this at the podcast entitled The Time Value of Money in Stocks. Because what happened is, if you owned stocks before the crash, say a year ago, today, say I'm recording this in August, so August of 2008. Your long-term return on stocks was so poor at those prices that your chances of meeting your goals in 10 years were not good. But now your portfolio is lower, but your long-term return is higher, and the net effect is your odds of meeting your goals have improved. And the calculator shows that. And I would like to have every middle-class investor in the United States see that calculator, see that guest blog entry. You'll find it at the Money and Such blog. And I link to it at my blog, A Rich Life blog. Or you can just use the calculator yourself and test it. Calculators at the website, Investment Strategy Tester. So that's what gets you through. When all these hammers are coming, you've got good news, really good news. And it gets you through. Whereas the passive investor, it's all bad news. Bad, 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 bad. That's not diversification. Diversification has to be not just diversifying volatility. Volatility is not that big a deal, really. It's not a little deal, but the passive investors make it out to be much more than it is. What you want is diversification of emotion. You don't want to be doom and gloom in five different directions all at the same time. You've got to have some good news. I call it the Gene Mock rule. Whenever things look really bad, they're better than they look. And whenever things look really good, they're worse than they look. And the stock return predictor reports that truth in a compelling way. So if you get to use the calculator on a regular basis, you won't forget when these things happen. That's true diversification, emotional diversification. So, I was talking about Harry Brown, and Harry Brown questioned the conventional wisdom on diversification, and he said, you need four asset classes for diversification, not two. You can't have stocks and bonds. He said you have to have 25% stocks, 25% bonds, 25% gold, 25% cash. He said there are four major asset classes, and you've got to have 25% of each to have true diversification. And his permanent portfolio is just own 25% of each and never change. It is a passive approach. I see a great deal of intellectual merit to it, theoretical merit. I considered it for my own plan. I couldn't pull the trigger because I just couldn't stand the thought. I knew that stocks were overvalued at the time. This was mid to late 90s. I said, I'd be owning one class that's overvalued and it's going to have bad long-term performance, stocks. I'd have one class, gold, which, you know, doesn't produce anything on a year-to-year basis. It goes up dramatically at times, but it doesn't produce anything. So, you know, I'm going to be living off my assets and I'm going to have 25% in an asset class not producing anything, 25% in cash, which produces low returns historically, and 25% in bonds, which I don't really study that much. I just didn't feel confident investing my money that way. It may work, and there is some historical data indicating it works, and I haven't studied in great depth. But I know Artie, who's a fine poster in our community, is a fan of this approach, and I think people should study it. I think it's worthy of examination. But the suggestion that Harry Brown made, is important, that where did this idea come up with that just owning stocks and bonds equals diversification? Where did that come from? This is just the stock selling industry. The idea of diversification is great. But then, you know, the sleight of hand trick is to say, look, here are all the reasons you should be diversified, and they make a great case. And then they're talking about stocks and bonds. Like, wait a minute, slow down, mister. Where did you come up with the idea that diversification, you can achieve it through only owning stocks and bonds and maybe a tiny bit of cash? Where did that come from? That's the nonsense part. That's the part that doesn't stand up to scrutiny. So Harry Brown is making an important point. He's saying you've got to own stocks, bonds, gold, and cash. You've got to own them all because they're all different. Stocks are an economic growth asset class, but they're also a highly emotional asset class, highly volatile. Bonds are sort of a stable growth. They would be stable if it weren't for inflation, but inflation has made bonds unstable, unfortunately. They're not as appealing as they used to be. Gold is essentially a commodity. And I think you could own other commodities rather than just gold. You could own oil or silver. Commodities have their benefits. The benefit of a commodity is that it's real. It's something you can hold in your hand. So all the emotion that goes into stocks doesn't exist with the commodities. Or it does exist. The price of gold is affected by emotion. But ultimately, there's something real there. And the theory is that reality will evidence itself over time. I think the hard one there is how long a time. That's what worries me. Cash is the stable asset class. Stable counts for something, people. This is what annoys me about passive investing. Cash is not some throwaway. They treat it like a trash asset class. Stability has got to be part of your plan, or your plan is not going to work. You've got to care about stability. If you care only about stability, you know, the boat's not going to sail. You know, if it's all rudder and no sail, it doesn't go anywhere. But if it's all sail and no rudder, it doesn't work either. So the trick is to combine these four, or, you know, if you follow the conventional model, it's to combine two, stocks and bonds. If you follow valuation-informed indexing, it's to combine stocks and tips. But the goal is to combine these in their proper proportions. And the problem with the conventional model is, yes, they sell us diversification, which is a real thing. It's real magic. It's a free lunch. But then they just happen by coincidence, by circumstance, they just happen to promote the two asset classes that they get big commissions on as the only two you need to own. And I say it's BS. You don't get diversification by owning only stocks and bonds. So if you want to go Harry Brown's route, own stocks, bonds, gold, and cash. My question about the Harry Brown route is, how do we know that we need to own equal proportions of all four? Where does that come from? I don't know the answer. I haven't studied in great depth. I read his book, but that was a long time ago. Maybe the permanent portfolio should be, you know, 50% stocks and you know, own these other three, you know, 1/6 each. I don't know. But I am uneasy with the idea of a 25% stock allocation as my permanent allocation. As I've said before, I am certainly not in favor of passive investing. I think it's dangerous and reckless, but I'm not as anti-stock as most other people who are critical of passive investing. I'm more of a pro-stock guy, and I have a hard time going with a 25% stock allocation as a permanent allocation. That I'll go with 25% stocks when stocks are priced like they were from 96 through 2008, but I'm not going to go 25% stocks when stocks are priced at a P10 level of 8 and the stock return predictor is telling me that the most likely 10-year return is 15% real, annualized. So, we don't have a final answer to these questions, but I'm giving you my take, and I'm letting you know what the takes are of some others, and we've got to throw them all into the mix, and, you know, we're never going to really have a final answer, but the more we discuss it, the sharper everybody will get in their thinking. So that's what we really need. We need to open these questions up for debate. We need to stop pretending that we know all the answers because we don't. Planning for transitions. You know, when I talk about how you need to include your job prospects in the diversification analysis, you need to include any plans you have for life transitions. This drives me crazy that people don't do this. What they do with passive investing is they say, well, it all depends on how long you're gonna before you retire. If you're 30 years from retirement, you can go with, you know, very, very heavy stock allocation, no matter what the valuation level. And I just think that's baloney, because what if in 10 years you're going to buy a house? Within 10 years. To buy a house, you're going to be putting money down on a mortgage. You're going to want to know how much in the way of assets do I have? Or say you want to start a business. How much in the way of assets do I have that I can take this chance, take this risk? You can't, or say you want to move to a different job. You want to move to a job that, you know, is in a different field, has great prospects in the long term, but it's a little risky. You might lose it. You know, the people don't know you as well. A lot of people, they start a new job, they lose the job in 6 months or a year. Can you take that chance? Well, you need to know what kind of assets you have. And if you're invested heavily in stocks, because your retirement's not for 30 years out, you could suffer a bone-crushing loss because stocks are overvalued. You could suffer an 80% loss, and then you can't afford to take that new job, or you can't afford to start that business, or you can't afford to buy that house, and you hurt yourself for many, many, many years to come. Part of diversification is being positioned for life transitions. Life transitions are what make you rich in the end. There are a small number of decisions you're going to make in the course of your life that are going to make a big difference. Buying your house isn't the most important, but it can be important. Buying the right house can make a big difference because it affects the contacts you make, the neighborhood you're going to live in, you know, whether you're safe, the kind of school your kids go to, whether you get appreciation on the house value. So choosing a house to live in is a big deal. You want to have as many options available to you as you can, and in order to have as many options, you want to have money in the bank when you make that choice. And very few of us are more than 30 years away from buying our first house. So there's no such thing as being able to wait 30 years for stocks to come around. You need to be looking at what's going to happen in stocks in 5 years or 10 years. And if it's not a house, then it's the possibility of starting a business. A lot more people are going to be starting their own businesses in years to come as the job situation becomes less and less stable. Or it could be just moving to a new job. Very few of us have one job from the 25 to 65. So you've got to be positioned to make a move. And if you're a passive investor, you're not, because you're locked into one asset class and one asset class only. And when that asset class goes down, you are frozen. All your choices are closed to you. All the paths are blocked. And it's foolish planning. There's no such thing as effective financial planning that does not include effective life planning. No such thing. What I mean by the phrase true diversification is it's not diversification unless it also includes diversification of life options. It's not just which asset class has the highest volatility. That's a cartoon version of how investing works. And we don't live in a cartoon world. And if you start investing your money according to these cartoon presumptions, you're going to get killed. Not next week or next month necessarily, but sometime. And we shouldn't be giving people this sort of advice. It's dangerous and it's reckless. It hurts human beings and other living things. So says Rob Bennett. International. John Bogle's asked this question all the time. John Bogle says you don't need to invest globally. Broad U.S. stock index is enough. Well, yes and no. To some extent, I share his trepidation about investing globally because a lot of global markets are not as transparent as the U.S. market. And if you don't understand the investment class, you're better off not getting involved in it. However, we are moving to a global economy. That's an argument for investing globally. If you invest in a broad global index, I would think you're protected from some of the lack of transparency. And we just can't assume that the U.S. market is going to be, you know, the market in the future as it has been in recent decades. That's just not a safe assumption. So there are risks with deciding to go just U.S. There are benefits too, and I don't rule it out. I think it makes sense, but I I don't like the dogmatism I sometimes see among passive investing advocates. And not all endorse that idea, Bogle. Some go against it. But some will endorse it just because Bogle said it, and that's not a good reason. You know, if he wants to say for some people this is the way to go, if you want to keep it simple this is the way to go, then yes. But it's wrong not to point out that there are some dangers there. People should know before they put their money on the table what the risks are. We should be upfront. So, not investing international, not investing globally, does carry risk. It's not a risk-free choice. There are some possible benefits, and there are risks to investing globally. You know, it cuts both ways. And there are no final answers. But we need to be more open about acknowledging what we don't know so that these questions get thrashed out more and so that different people can form different takes. We need to avoid the dogmatism. That's really the point here. Can diversification ever hurt? I think so, especially if you choose asset classes you don't understand. I've said that. There's danger in that. Diversification can hurt if you don't know the time period in which the diversification is going to pay off. This is the big problem I have with the Harry Brown approach, the permanent portfolio approach. You know, it could be that in 100 years, the Harry Brown approach works. But I don't have 100 years, you know? Gold can go for long periods of time without generating any return. And so I don't know that I have a tiny bit of gold. Tiny bit of silver. But I can't afford to go 25% gold in my portfolio. I can't. I don't feel I can anyway. Right or wrong, I don't believe I can. So it's not for me. I do think it's worth exploring. I do think there's a lot of intellectual firepower there. I think Brown makes a great point in saying that you don't get enough diversification just being stocks and bonds. But I can't afford to have that higher percentage in gold in my circumstances. I tend to think, you know, another risk of diversification is stocks might really be best. And if stocks are best, you don't want to be over-diversified. You're lowering your return by being over-diversified. I think the passive investors are onto something when they don't say 50-50 stocks bonds. A lot of them say 60 stocks or 70 stocks. And I think they're onto something. If stocks give the higher return, you don't want pure diversification. Yes, you do want diversification because you don't want to take this bone-crushing hit. But you also want return and you know, you don't want to diversify just for the sake of being diversified. So, you know, you can't go with these simple mathematical formulas. 50-50 is obviously very simple. If one of the asset classes is providing a return better than the other, you want to tilt it that way. You want to be thinking about what you're going through at any particular stage of your life when you're deciding on how much diversification you want and how to achieve that diversification. This, you know, my life is a great example of this. I've been saying on, you know, on our boards, the retire early and indexing boards, for what, 7 years? Going back to May 2002, I've been saying, I think middle-class investors, the typical middle-class investor should always hold some stocks. I said that stock prices were insane from 1996 through 2008. And I've said the numbers indicate you should have been at a zero stock allocation for those years. But I always have said, and I've said this thousands of times, if not, you know, thousands, I think, not just hundreds. I've said, you know, if you want to go a zero, you know, do that, but I think it's risky. I think the typical investor should be at something like 20 to 30% stocks, even at times of insane overvaluation. Why? Because we can't short-term time the market. We can't time the market in the short term. You could go to a 0% stock allocation and stocks could double. And you would miss out, and that would cause emotional pressure on you that could cause you to make bad decisions. That's not effective diversification in my mind. So one of the benefits of diversification is to avoid this emotional stress. That's the point of it, really. One of the big points. It's part of the magic. So even when stocks look very, very bad, I argue for investing 20% of your money in stocks just for the diversification edge. But I didn't do that, did I? I got out of stocks entirely in the summer of 96. I think the P10 level was about 26. So we were at insanely dangerous prices. The historical data indicated a 0% stock allocation was best, but I personally didn't believe that because it's too undiversified. And look what happened. Great stock returns in 97, 98, 99. Things played out just as I thought they might, not patting myself on the back. I learned it from the historical data, and the historical data was just right. It was a good guy. That's all. But it played out the way, I wouldn't say the way I expected. I didn't predict this, but I knew it was an option. I knew it was a possibility. I knew it was one scenario. Why didn't I stay in stocks? Why didn't I have 30% in stocks so that I would have made money in those years? Well, there was a good reason. And I think you need to understand this reason in order to understand how to make diversification work for you. The reason I went to zero stocks is, this was in 96, I was planning to leave my corporate job, you know, go into freelance writing, which is a highly unstable, the most unstable career field there is next to poet and ballet dancer. And I wanted to get out of that corporate job as soon as I could. And I felt the earliest I can make it would be, say, the year 2000. But I was thinking maybe 2000, maybe 2001, maybe 2002. You know, I wasn't sure what year. But 2000 was the earliest, I think. And I left my job in August of 2000. Say that I had gone with 30% stocks in summer 96 when I made my choice. And say that we experienced an 80% drop in stock prices in 97, which was clearly on the table. We were at insanely overpriced stock values. And we've seen an 80% drop in the past, so this wouldn't have been shocking. I mean, it would have shocked a lot of people, but not rightly so. They should have been anticipating it. It clearly was a scenario. I wouldn't say it was likely, but it was in the range of possibility. Say we had experienced that. I've got 30% in stocks, and 80% of that money is gone. So I don't know. Just say I had $1 million. I didn't have anywhere close. But just say, to make the numbers easy, if I had $1 million, I had 300,000 in stocks. I lose 80%. That's a loss of $240,000. Could Rob Bennett afford to lose $240,000 when he was desperate to hand in his corporate resignation to get started with a new stage of his life? No way, no how. Now, my point is, you can't decide on how to diversify without thinking, where is my life headed today? Where is it headed in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years? Forget about retirement. If you're 35 years old, you're not going to be retiring for 30 years. Forget about it. Where are you going to be at 40? Where are you going to be at 45? Where are you going to be at 50? If you think there's a chance you're going to be starting your own business or moving to a different job or buying a house or doing anything that requires money, having kids, expanding the house, sending your kids to college, any of these things, anything that requires money, being out of work, you need to factor that into your diversification analysis. Now, some people are going to say, wait a minute, Rob, you're throwing in too many factors. I can't handle it all. I'm not a supercomputer. You don't need to be a supercomputer. My goal is to provide lots of tools so you can figure these things out to a far greater extent than is possible today with the tools that exist today. That's my job. We've got tools at the site now. We got 4 calculators, unique calculators, not available anywhere else on the internet, but I hope to have more days to come. John Walter Russell and I are working on the 5th calculator today, the buy and hold reality checker. But The tools won't address every single question. I hope to address as many of these questions as we can, but they won't address every question. But you don't need that. You don't need to get everything precisely right. Roughly right will do it. But you do need to consider these factors. You can't, what the passive investing advocates are telling you to do is forget about all this stuff. Forget about the fact you need to move into a new house. Forget about the fact your kids need to go to college in 5 years. Forget about the fact that you might want to try a new career. And I'm saying, if your stock portfolio, if you're heavy in stocks at a time of insane overvaluation and you see a 70% loss in your stock portfolio, it's going to close doors to you, and the price you're going to pay over the course of a lifetime, because you never move to that better job, or your kids don't go to college, or you can't make the switch to the new neighborhood you want to live in and where you want to make friends, and you've lessened your life enhancement in a very, very, very serious way, and I say it's foolish. And I say it hurts people. And we need to get this word out. I'm worked up today, friends and neighbors. I don't know. My wife must have said something rude this morning. I'm hot. She didn't, but maybe I dreamed it. I'm hot today. Holy moly. I'm feeling pain. I'm feeling other people's pain today. I think that's what it is. You need to look at these factors. You don't need to study them in great depth. You need to think about them. And that's part of the diversification exercise. In other words, if you've got things coming up in the next 10 years, and most of us do, some to a greater extent than others, here's the point. Say you've got a super safe job. Say you're in an industry where, you know, you're in a super safe company, nobody ever loses their job, and, you know, you can afford to take more risk in your investment side of things. Say you're in a risky job. You're in the advertising industry. People get fired every 6 months. You should be playing it safer with your investment portfolio. In other words, risk is organic. We need an organic understanding of risk. Risk isn't just what's your stock allocation. Risk is what's going on in your life. And there are times in all of our lives when things are going sort of stable, you know, sort of humdrum. And those times are nice in a way. They're not exciting, but they're you know, good sleeping, good sleeping weather. No, I mean, I enjoy those times. Other times are a bumpy ride. Well, if you've got a bumpy ride going on in your life, you don't want a bumpy ride going on in your investment side, because you'll make mistakes. And you can only take so much bumpiness at a time. But if you've got a stable ride, well, maybe it could shake things up a little bit. Have a little, you know, mix in a little gambling there on the investing side. Spice things up a little bit. Plus, you can think clearly, and if anything starts to go wrong, you've got the attention to devote to it, to set it straight. These are diversification questions, in Rob Bennett's opinion. It's about diversification is a life planning process, not just a financial planning process. That's my take. That's the point of the title, True Diversification. Last point, I'm just circle back to the beginning. You want to keep this, are you worried that I'm adding some work on your plate? I'm putting a new burden on you. I'm talking about life diversification. You're going to have to think, well, is my job stable? Am I going to need new, I can send my kids to college? How's my stock? Fine. If that's a new burden, I'm telling you, you got to think about it at least a little bit. If you want to ease your burden, go simple on the investing side. Two asset classes will do it, I think. I'd like to hear other people's opinions, but I think two will do it. A broad U.S. stock index and Treasury inflation-protected securities, mixed in the appropriate mix depending on the valuation level for stocks. Simple as simple can be, covers all possibilities that I know of and that I've been able to think about. I'd like to know what you think. If you have some comments, please contact me at the Contact Rob button on the left side of every page at the website, passionsaving.com. Good luck with your efforts to diversify. Good luck with your investing strategies.